Hi everyone, this is Ian Gardner here, bringing you the fortnightly news show. It's actually not fortnight this time, it's 3 week cycle because of some news, which is that Gelix, which is the other hat where we raised our first venture fund, or the first close of it, I should say. We did that a couple of weeks ago, and that was very distracting and kept me away from the microphone last week. So we are back though, and we have an amazing panel. So I pulled together, I guess they're leaders from the ecosystem, but they've also got just an incredible wealth of experience and knowledge. Lauren Kaplan is the principal at Startmate. Michael Batko is the CEO at Startmate. And there's a reason we've got two Startmate people on. The scale of Startmate's ambition to get a million people into Startmate City, I think they're calling it, in the next 10 years is just unbelievable. So much so I wanted two of them in the show. And Alex Scandara. So Alex is a great guy. He was the ex-CEO at Stone & Chalk, and he'd been in that role for 6.5 years. So again, really helped shape the ecosystem, knows so much about fintech and a lot of other things. So fantastic panel, really good stories. Yeah, let's jump over to them and hear the news. All right, and welcome to the show. We have a fantastic panel that we've just told you about. So Lauren, Michael, and Alex. It's not been a fortnight, it's been 3 weeks. So there's a lot of news to cover, some really good stuff going on. Part of the reason for that 1 week delay was because Gelix, which is the fund I'm with, did the first close of our fund. And that's actually was quite a lot of work. So it just made doing a podcast in the middle of it quite challenging. So I think we'll touch on that later. Before we start, we might just do a quick round the panel and get everyone's insight as to what they're doing and what they're up to. I might start with you, Alex, because in theory you're unemployed, but you had an amazing run, 6 years as the CEO and I guess founder of Stone & Chalk. It's transitioned from just a pure fintech play to a bit more of a general incubator, co-working space. Yeah, tell us what you've been up to and why you're moving on.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. You know, when we were kicking off, I thought I'd be in the role for about 2 years. And I remember quite fondly talking together about Stone & Chalk and some of the thoughts around what it could be. And, you're quite right. It's been about 6.5 years, 6 years since Stone & Chalk opened its doors. And we're now in probably the three biggest markets in the country. So, you know, Sydney, Melbourne, and Adelaide, quite a lot going on. And, you know, I think it's time. You know, you get to a point where you realize there's only so much more you can do. And we're at the point in Stone & Chalk's journey where we've just completed the merger and integration with AusCyber. And with the new strategy that we've put in place, it's a really good juncture for someone new to come in and take the helm and really move Stone & Chalk forward to its next level of growth. And so for me personally, one of the key things that I wanted to make sure of is that whenever I did move forward or onto something else, that Stone & Chalk would be in a great position. There'd be a legacy I'd be able to leave behind, and it'd be able to continue to progress and to grow. And that's very much where it's at today. And so I think from my perspective, it's just good timing.
Yeah, I think you can definitely look back with some pride and what you've been able to do. I mean, are there any metrics that you think about or share in terms of the progression?
Oh, look, one of the key things that we've always measured ourselves against is the cumulative funding that our residents and alumni have always been able to secure. The latest that we've got internally is that we've just hit $600 million. It hasn't been widely broadcast with everything that's happening around COVID across the country. But for us, that's just, you know, such a phenomenal figure that we're just so proud of. We've got approximately 2,000 people that are directly employed by our residents and alumni. And, you know, we kicked off with 100 residents in 2015, and we've now got about 1,000 across Sydney, Melbourne, and Adelaide, which is great. And so for us, you know, that's really the three killer KPIs, if you will, that we always think about.
Yeah. And just quickly, what's next? Are you looking for a job? Do you want anyone listening to get in touch?
Well, you know, you're always selling, mate, and BD is always on the mind. But, there's a couple of things that come to mind. You know, there's the potential to potentially, you know, help some founders with scaling their businesses. There's starting something myself. And maybe even dabbling in some funds. So there's a few things that I need to sort out and think through. And, you know, as lots of founders and leaders have found, no doubt that it's really hard sometimes to do that when you're really flat out and running 100 miles an hour. And so that's what I'm working through right now.
Oh, well, good on you, and congrats on what you've got. I mean, it's you have certainly played a pretty big role in this ecosystem and helping it develop. So good on you. So we actually got two people from Startmate here today. So Lauren and Michael. Now, you probably noticed just generally in terms of who we get as guests that there's always a linkage back to the news. And Startmate was on the front cover of the Australian's top 100 innovators. You even had to all dress up. And the photo shoot must have been done pre-lockdowns. But yeah, you all put on a suit and tie and some fancy clothes, and you appeared looking very dapper in the front cover. Let me just start with Michael, because I jumped on a call that you did with the Startmate groups last week, and you kind of talked through what you were doing. So, why is Startmate in the news, Michael?
It was very much related to our 10-year mission. So, I've published kind of our 10-year master plan earlier this year, and it was picked up by the Australian. And now that Startmate is expanding faster than ever, that kind of mission to become the epicenter of startup ambition is kind of going to the next level. And the next level for us is actually building a physical million people city anywhere in Australia or New Zealand. And that is very much a 10-year plan. But it is actually also goes to the whole idea of we tell our startups to always be ambitious, but we should be ambitious ourselves as well.
So a million person city, I mean, a million people is a lot. I mean, Perth is a million people, I think. Is that right? Maybe a little more than that. You know, so you're talking about building a city with a sort of innovation focus within 10 years with a million people in it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
I love it. It's like Elon Musk getting a million people to Mars. You kind of hear a statement like that and you're like, that is bonkers. I mean, I guess in comparison to that, it's probably not quite as ambitious, but it's still, I mean, I mean, 1 million people is about 3% of Australia. So how are you going to do it?
Yeah, totally. So there's three reasons cities actually get started. One is a simple one. The government tells people to relocate because a new capital is established. The second one is because of economic factors, which is like a port and resources. But there's actually a third reason for a city to start, which is common belief and shared values, which is how cities are started around religions, which is how cities are started around shared values, essentially. And Startmate City is exactly in that bucket where if you take people who are ambitious and you put them in one place, they will automatically attract other people who want to be building a similar future to them. And you actually become this magnet for people with kind of the same essentially outlook on the world. And that's exactly the kind of city you would want to be creating to drive innovation forward and to be working on the future of Australia and New Zealand. So the plan itself is essentially, what we've done already at Startmate is done the hard part. We've got a community of thousands and thousands of ambitious people. Right now that is fully remote and everybody's working from home, but ultimately we all care about our surroundings. And now that you can actually relocate so easily, it is about relocating that kind of community to one place. And then those people in return will be attracting many, many, many more people to actually come to the same place.
I didn't know this until we chatted before we started, but you yourself have relocated. So you've gone from Sydney Newcastle, I think, to Melbourne.
Yeah.
Why the move?
Yeah. So similar here, like with COVID, what we all realized is that we all don't actually have to work from the same place where jobs are, where you need to come together, but you can actually relocate based on lifestyle and where you'd rather be. So I have lived now in Newcastle for a year and a half, and it was amazing because of my girlfriend's family who was there. But now I've also realized for myself, I actually do want to be closer to where things are happening. So I actually just relocated down to Melbourne 2 months ago, just to be closer to everybody working kind of in the startup industry.
Well, good on you. Lauren, let's go to you. Talking of relocation, again, I didn't realize this, but you've now moved to Noosa. So yeah, anyway, Lauren Kaplan, you are basically the investor at StartMate. But yeah, tell us about that and why you ended up in Noosa.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Ian. I guess I can probably be a bit of a bridge between the two other guests, Michael and Alex. Obviously, I wasn't quite at the launch party for Stone & Chalk, but was based out of there for 5 years, or for a couple of years with Reinventure. But yeah, we moved to Noosa in December last year. I had my second little one in February, just a pre-COVID baby. And when I started chatting to Michael about the role at StartMate, as you said, principal, looking for the most ambitious founders across Australia and New Zealand. The role was advertised as remote, and basically the discussions began with, I would love to do this, but I would mainly love to do this from the Sunshine Coast, which is where all my family is. And surprisingly, has been an incredible way to approach the role. I guess it's given me an outside of Sydney context for the most part. You really keep that regional lens on what you're doing, because you have to try a little bit harder to seek out the right people. But of course, you know, coming together with everybody when we can, as we were discussing before the call, you know, being in Adelaide with everybody earlier this year was just such an incredible thing. But again, when you can come together for moments like that, being based in a capital city like Sydney doesn't necessarily have the same appeal. And for sure, I'm kind of interested in what StartMate City could potentially look like up here as well. So we're exploring all
options. So you think StartMate, I guess there's a fundamental question, like what sort of weather should StartMate City have? Is it the Noosa climate, or is it going to be more Hobart? Because in theory, the cold and challenging climate makes people more productive. That's why the Scottish invented the modern world, because it was a shit weather and there was nothing else to do. So,
and I think if you are forecasting if you were bringing climate change into your lens at all, you know, Hobart probably becomes more attractive over time. But certainly right now, the Sunshine Coast is a pretty good place to be.
Yeah. Any other comments in StartMate City that Michael didn't cover? I mean, what's when you started talking about it and hearing about it, what did you feel?
I think the thing that excites me most is just, the proximity factor. I used to actually work for an architectural firm back in the day in a past life, and these ideas of, you know, bump spaces used to get talked a lot about. I think it's all well and good in this remote world. We create community online. We've been able to deliver the accelerator now and our other programs like the fellowship and First Believers a couple of times over since lockdown began for the first time last year. But there's nothing like seeing people face to face and creating those more intentional opportunities to connect. So I see it as just the kind of physical manifestation of everything we are able to do virtually now, and create that bridge.
Right, well, now we should ask Alex about this. I mean, so StartMate City, Alex, I mean, 1 million people, which is 2.5 times the size of Canberra. I mean, what do you think when you hear this?
Well, look, I think it's great. It's a great concept, and full believer in big ambition. And I was just thinking too, just listening to what Michael and Lauren were saying, that it might be worth picking up the phone and looking to see if there's a collaboration opportunity between Stone & Chalk and StartMate. I think combining some of the strengths and learnings and experience of the two organizations and collaborating in a way that, frankly, I don't think Australian organizations do well enough, might actually accelerate that vision. I think StartMate brings a great skill in the whole programmatic part of their accelerator networks, and they've launched the fellowship program that they've been talking about recently as well. Whereas Stone & Chalk, what it has done really well is build that community that's evolved into an impact network as well, and leveraging physicality and bringing the best of what Lauren was just talking about together in terms of those bump points. That could be quite interesting.
And Michael, has your phone been running red hot with calls like that from other organizations? Because, you know, the reality is, to get 1 million people, you're going to need to collaborate with everyone, aren't you?
Yeah, totally. So there's a couple of fronts here. Like, one is we literally have on the website now a sign-up form where people can register their interest, which has been pretty interesting. And they can even tell us how they want to contribute to StartMate City. So we've had a bunch of people submit that are ready to buy land. On the other side, lots of state governments, councils have been approaching me. So New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, actually Christchurch, and Sunshine Coast. Actually, Queensland is probably the front runner here with quite a few different councils reaching out. And on the final layer is actually even just the smaller stuff where lots of StartMate alumni have actually reached out. So, for example, Bardi, which wants to do the waste management, Cake Equity, which wants to do the ESOP plan for the city, and F5B, which wants to do the solar grid for the city and stuff. So it's quite interesting to even see all of the startups get around it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's great.
But I think to your point, Ian, and then Alex as well, just StartMate has always had this, I guess, reputation as the Switzerland of the startup ecosystem. And in fact, we very much see the need to collaborate with parties across all different types, you know, whether that's the investors or the co-working spaces, the startups themselves. I think there is just this opportunity to bring everybody together for this conversation.
Yeah. Well, look, best of luck with it. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it over the coming weeks and years to come, Michael. But yeah, congrats on the vision. I mean, I think it's great that you've set the vision out there and it's got picked up by some press and you've got a bunch of interest, including talking about it here. So yeah, love it. Okay, we should talk about some of the news. So like I also mentioned at the top, there's a few funds, including Gelix, which is the one that I'm part-time with, that have just announced their first close. Gelix has raised, it said 15 million in the article, but it's more like 17. So it's an ESVCLP. We're focused on the seed stage. It's run by Andrea Gardner, who I happen to be married to. She's amazing. You know, it's one of the few, like there's a lack of women generally in VC, and Lauren, I'll maybe jump to you and ask about that. But, you know, Andrea is one of the rarest breeds, you know, a woman not only as a senior partner in VC, but who has founded a VC company. And Alex, you've worked with Andrea too. She was on the board of Stone and Chalk as one of the residents for a few years. 20% of the LPs are female, which doesn't sound like a huge number, but again, as anyone who knows, it's a tough number to get up. So we're actually pretty pleased with that. And over, I think it's 35% of our portfolio founders are female too. Some of the notable LPs, Daniel Petrie, David Shane, which I was surprised about with both of them. You know, why would a GP from another fund come into our fund? But, you know, they liked what we were doing and they, I guess, wanted some exposure to the deals. Michael Malone from IINet, Tim Burrows from Umbrella, Tim Power from Athletics. I mean, I'm banging on a bit because I'm so delighted that we get to talk about it. Any thoughts, Lauren and Alex in particular, because you've worked with Andrea on this one. So let's go Lauren first.
Yeah, I actually got to work back to back with Andrea when we were at Stone and Chalk for a very brief period of time when we were based on that side of the floor. And yeah, I just have always found Andrea to be one of these most approachable and generous people in the ecosystem, especially supportive of, you know, younger women coming up and really making making herself, I guess, the mentor mother hen of that side of the ecosystem. So I'm incredibly delighted for your news, and of course Elon as well, just a great partner in the mix there as well. So congrats to him.
Yeah.
I think it's an awesome sign of, you know, the continuing growth of that end of the ecosystem, where we have more and more incredible early stage startups. Obviously, that's what StartMate's trying to bring up the curve as well, and to know that there are places like Gelix that we can be, sharing our alumni companies with and supporting them to get that investment. I actually had a great chat with Alan on Friday last week to share the Winter 21 cohort. Yeah, so great. I'm excited to see what's of interest.
Yeah, and I should have mentioned that when I was talking about Alan Greenspan, who is our, joined us as a sort of fairly young investment associate. We promoted him to manager, and now we've just promoted him to partner because he's amazing. He's so good at what he does. He works really hard. He's really smart. He's great with the founders. So just, we couldn't have a better person there. Alex, you worked with Andrea on the board at Stone and Chalk for a while. Any insights or any thoughts on this news?
Oh, look, I think it's great. And congratulations really to Andrea and yourself, mate. You know, it's interesting. When you get to know people for long enough, you get to see progression. And, you know, it's been great to have known Andrea for so many years and to see her from the earlier days of Stone and Chalk, where she was on the board and she was also quite an active angel investor and a key part of our mentor program as we kicked that off, and to see how that's evolved from, you know, investing as an individual angel to then putting together syndicates of angels and running that for some time, and then to get to the point now where you've succeeded in launching a fund, I mean, that's fantastic. And, you know, one of the key things that we've continued to see is holding back startups in Australia is that we still think that there's a funding gap in the seed stage, that there's been quite a large acceleration of growth in the Series A onwards with a lot of VCs that have emerged and funds, which is fantastic. And one of the most exciting things, I think, with GLIX in particular is that it's focusing on the seed stage, and we need a lot more GLIXs out there. So it's fantastic news to hear you guys close that and really oversubscribe, from what I understand, Ian. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't say oversubscribe, but it's certainly we plan to close at 10 because that's the ESVC LP number. And, you know, it's funny, it's just there came a tipping point probably 2 months ago when everyone we'd been talking to for months is like, oh, you know, Jimmy's in, so, oh, maybe I should come in. You know, it's kind of like what party? No one wants to hear that. So, you know, once that what party chatter starts, then it just became a bit easier. But look, I have to say, just personally, I mean, this is one of the toughest things I've ever done in my career. You know, it was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be, just because of the volume. And I remember hearing it from Blackbird and, you know, Rick and Nikki when they raised their first fund. And, it, you know, similar structure, like we've got over 100 LPs, you know, investors in the fund, which is a lot, you know, and each of them needs personal care and attention and pitching. And that is just a lot. It's incredibly unscalable in terms of a process, and just very, very difficult. So, you know, you have to have a great network, good reputation, good track record, you know, and I think we had all that, but even with that, it was still really, really hard. Anyway.
So share that with people for a second, Ian, for those that are thinking about doing something similar out there. What was the time period, would you just say, to go from formal pitching to closing? How many did you pitch to get your 100 LPs, for example?
We kind of started late 2019, you know, just before, you know, we went away for the summer and we talked about it, and we said, okay, when we get back, we're going to properly raise the fund. So this is back early last year, and we had pretty good momentum. We reckon we were sitting around the sort of 5+ million in commitments, and then COVID came along and it completely derailed. It took all the wind out of our sails. Like, everyone was just running around with their head cut off. You know, like a chicken with his head cut off. So it kind of put a huge pause on it. People came back and we started doing investing again as a syndicate in July. And then, you know, we thought we weren't going to go hard in the fund again. And then it wasn't until this January, really, that we dusted the cover, you pulled the covers off and started going again. So it's basically taken us from January to now to get all of that head of steam and momentum, which is, and learnings. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, there's no compression algorithm for experience. This is one of the things we used to talk about at Amazon, but it applies here too. You know, the only way to experience it is to do it. So yeah, it's a very time consuming and tough process. Yeah. You know, and look, if it wasn't for the, you know, we've been investing as a syndicate for 6 years. And without that 6 years of track record, then I don't think we could have raised the fund. So yeah, no, it's very hard.
Yeah, great. Congratulations, mate.
Yeah, thank you. No, I appreciate that. And I'm sorry, it probably took longer than we could have done. So that was a bit of self-interest there. But yeah, no, I got to say, I've never been happier in a job as doing what I'm doing right now. And that's both Innovation Bay and GLIX. It's just so much fun hanging out with people like you and the whole ecosystem. It is just great. You know, and if it works, then, you know, we should make some money for our investors and for us as a consequence. And, you know, that's exciting too. But it's not about the money, it's about the impact. So the other one we wanted to talk about was the after work. So we talked about the, you know, seed stage. You know, after work is a VC that's just launched it, just closed a $10 million fund. Four young guys. I can't remember where they're all based. I think some in Melbourne, some are in Sydney, or maybe they're all in Sydney. But
there's a bit of a Western Australian contingent.
Is there? Right. So Lauren, like, let me throw to you and give us your understanding and take in this one, because it's good news here.
Yeah, I think this is a really awesome development in the ecosystem as well. Generally, what we're seeing with something like Afterwork is the operator talent coming back into the ecosystem as investors as well. So that's very much the premise that Afterwork was formed on, I believe. And you've got Dave Insel, who's obviously got the fintech background as well, but the other partners, I think, are across, maybe Sydney and Perth. I think it's an interesting model as it, I guess, brings more awareness to that early stage investment side of things. They've obviously come from a bit more of a syndicate style model to raise their fund as well. So we'll be seeing more of this kind of, thing forming from the ground up. And I'd say, through the StartMate lens, the First Believers program is very much about this investor education. There are more and more people who've worked in startups who are really just itching to understand how this whole thing of investing in startups works. How do you even know, what good looks like, what you should be looking for in a business from an investment standpoint? And I think it definitely reduces the risk when you are joining with others to kind of make a shared decision on that front, which is why syndicates and funds, are a great place to start. So I think we're excited to see that investor education kind of spread across the ecosystem, because it can only benefit these early stage startups.
Yeah, and there's definitely some parallels between how they've done it and how Gelix did it. So, I mean, they started back in 2017, and it was really, I think they called it, Zoom calls after work, which was part of why they were doing it. And they basically brought in founders to pitch to a bunch of people in the calls, and then kind of built a syndicate off the back of that. But it's, Alex Kaur, Adrian Peterson, Dave Insel, as you said, Lauren, and Mike Forster. So,
I think really, it's great. Really and, good. Alex, one of the things that I really like about it is how it's evolved.
Any insight in this one?
One of the things that we found early on is that there just wasn't a group or a community that was established around investing in any type of startup, really. And so we ended up having to use mentor programs as a way of farming angel investors, if you will. And so I love how this has evolved, and I agree with Lauren 100%. I think there's going to be a range of these hopefully starting to evolve and expand across the country, either as more and more people that are becoming familiar with startups and how they work get a bit of a nous for sniffing a good quality opportunity. And what I'm hoping also is that as more and more people mentor and get involved in supporting founders, that likewise they become members of advisory boards, they get much more involved, their sense of fear to do with risk starts to diminish because they get more experience, and then eventually they become angel investors themselves, and then hopefully at some stage end up with something like Afterwork VC as well. So really exciting to see something like this actually now start to take place.
Yeah. And Michael, we should hear from you in this as well. I mean, just do you want to touch on that funding gap that, I think you mentioned it before, but any more color in the funding gap at the seed stage?
Well, maybe let me tie both those themes together, which is kind of the emerging new investor space, but also how hard it is to raise a fund space. And so what we just did at StartMate is, or about to close is, what we call a small bets fund, which is just $1 million compared to the 17 million, I think you mentioned, from Gelix closed. But it is, the idea of actually bringing new investors into the ecosystem, which are mostly First Believers in our case, which are, for example, operators, who want to be exposed to startups and founders themselves. And here as well, so it resonates with me, your fundraising journey, because it has been the journey of approaching 100, 200 people kind of thing and getting some very small checks and getting a lead as well, potentially, and pulling that kind of fund together, which took way longer than I expected as well. And that should be closing in the next month or two.
Well, all right. Well, look, thank you. Let's maybe keep rolling on with some other news. Canva Cracks is number 3 in the Forbes Cloud 100 list. So again, it's this feels like a bit of a clickbait sort of article. It's hey, here's the best 100 cloud companies. I think there's 88 of them are in the US, which I don't know whether that's a surprise or not, but there's 3 Aussies in there. So Canva's at number 3. CultureAmp, I think, was next in the list. Can't remember what number they were at, but sort of top 50. And AirWallex as well. And it's based on how good a place it is to work, the, size of revenue. I think Stripe was number 1 and Databricks was number 2. So, Stripe's about $100 billion worth and Databricks is about 30. I think Canva's sitting around 20 or 30. So do these things, who wants to answer this one? Maybe let's throw it to Alex. Do these things matter, Alex?
Look, I think the main takeaway for me on that is the fact that we have 3 Australian companies in that list when there's 88 American. And it's quite interesting to see the grouping where, you know, you've got Canva, CultureAmp, AirWallex, three completely different companies offering completely different propositions in completely different sectors. So for me, it's a huge encouragement, and it's a sign of just how far Australia has come in 5 to 6 years, right? If we look at these companies, they're probably, what, 6 to 7 year vintage or so, and thereabouts. And so to have three of them in that top 100 list is just a phenomenal achievement. And it just, to me, says, well, imagine where we could be in another 5 years' time.
Lauren, Canva, I mean, we often talk about them. I mean, sometimes I feel that, you know, Mel and Cliff are a little under the radar, certainly in the Australian scene, but you cannot fault their talent and ambition. I mean, it's just unbelievable what Canva's done. And I guess this is just validating that.
Yeah, absolutely. And almost to riff off Alex's point, I think the fact that you've got this kind of enterprise technology, you've got Canva being more consumer focused, but obviously moving up the chain, and then AirWallex coming from more of a fintech background, that we could be developing strengths in those areas as a country is kind of long overdue, but it is a testament to the ambition that Mel and Cliff had, because before Canva, we were very much allergic to consumer-facing tech in Australia, I think. But I would also say the kind of undertone of this is that what we see from the people working at Canva and the people working at CultureAmp and the like are what is fueling the startup ecosystem at that next level as well. They're the ones who are doing the mentoring and the investing and that generation of talent that's been created through participation and involvement in the growth of companies like Canva is the really exciting part of this new story, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And Michael, like you were, our StartMate was number one in the top 100 innovators. Canva's number three in the top 100 cloud companies. I mean, are these, you know, as I asked Alex, are these top 100 lists just designed to sell newspapers, or is there some substance here?
I don't think those lists are very comparable. But it is definitely, what Canva's done for the entire ecosystem for Australia is absolutely unbelievable. I really resonate with Lauren's point here, where it is actually the next generation which Canva is building up as well. They are mentoring now startups, investing in startups. When their operators in Canva leave, they will start their own startups, just like Atlassian has done for the ecosystem. And the same thing for CultureAmp and AirWallex as well. It's almost like the most exciting part of it is almost like the next level and layer of startups which will result off the back of this news.
Yeah. Anyway, congrats Canva and AirWallex and CultureAmp. Love your work. And keep it up. All right, let's keep going. This article, when I'd read it, it's like, oh yeah, was that really in the last 3 weeks? I mean, it feels like this was announced a while ago, but the Tech Council, which is basically a reinvented version of Startup Oz, has been announced. I interviewed Alex McCauley, who was the founder at Startup Oz and is now doing an MBA in Stanford. But he was kind of the genesis behind trying to morph from Startup Oz into the Tech Council. And it just feels like it's, I don't know whether it's a fair analogy, but it's like the skinny guy that goes into that booth and comes out as Captain America. And I'm not saying that Alex was a skinny guy and he's now Captain America, but, Startup Oz was a skinny guy and, you know, the Tech Council feels like it could be Captain America, just a bigger, beefier version that can actually represent the startup ecosystem to, you know, the public and to politicians better than it was. Michael, you got any thoughts on this one?
One of the mind-blowing facts which came out of the first conversation we've had, which resonated with me, was that the tech industry is actually the third largest industry in Australia now. And the other one, which I loved, was that 860,000 Australians work in the tech industry, which is
so say that again, 860,000.
860,000, yeah.
That is massive.
Mm. So that's the beginning of StartMate City right there.
I was going to say, all of them should immediately move to StartMate City.
That's right. That's the starting point.
And Lauren, any thoughts in this one? Like, let me ask this. Like, does Australia need a tech council? Do we need a voice to government and to the public?
Yeah, look, as I have had the experience with FinTech Australia, both kind of in its early founding and then sitting on the board for 2 years, I think the role that it played in galvanizing the FinTech ecosystem in Australia as being the really significant pillar that it is, just goes to show how important somebody to translate these conversations between industry and government can be. And I think the reason FinTech Australia worked was because of how specific some of these policy changes could be. I think the kind of OG Startup Oz had a really important role to play in just even getting everyone to take the startup industry seriously, to be honest, and doing a lot of the research around the significance and the size of the startup kind of side of the economy. What I hope for its rebirth through the Tech Council is that actually now we have this platform where there is a lot more shared understanding of the right levers to pull. There are some really significant issues that the kind of industry is behind and looking for change on, whether that's the kind of research and development side of things, the kind of ESOP regulation that enables companies to properly kind of incentivize employees. And, you know, one thing to kind of link back a whole bunch of the conversations we've been having, one thing that I'm particularly excited about and, you know, have been kind of encouraging conversation around is the a shift around our understanding of what it is to be a sophisticated investor. And I think that this starts to have a knock-on effect to all of the other kind of emerging fund conversations that we've been having, where there are some regulatory requirements that actually are not consistent with what it might take for somebody to be a kind of meaningful early stage investor. And in fact, we are currently regulating people under a particular net worth out of those more significant opportunities of being invested in a fund or a syndicate, just purely because of that income threshold. So I hope that that's one of those issues that the whole industry is able to get behind through something like Tech Council and actually make change on.
Yeah, and it's definitely a powerful board that Alex has assembled. I mean, the chair is Robin Denholm, who's the chair at Tesla as well. So she has to manage Elon Musk. And I guess if you can do that, you can do anything. Scott Farquhar, that we may have heard of, is on there, Atlassian's co-CEO. Anthony Eisen from Afterpay. Cliff Albrecht from Canva. Oh, look,
I think it's a Mina great team. And as you were saying earlier, it does look like
These are revamped very players. Much of Alex, what's your take?
I think one of the key things that I'm hoping they get right is that it does advocate for the sector at large. One of the things that I'm mindful of is the fact that there is a double-edged sword of they've got these great heavy hitters from really successful companies now that are on the board. But those firms have very different focus areas, very different priorities, very different needs than what a founder actually needs and what Lauren was talking about in terms of sophisticated investors. Looking at ESIC and looking at what qualifies someone for actually being able to invest into this asset class. And so I think it's going to be really important to make sure that the Tech Council takes a good look at what are the breadth of issues that the startup ecosystem and the emerging technology sector needs to succeed, so that everyone can get behind them as a platform and really leverage that as the way to get advocacy through. And I'd really encourage them back to that point around collaboration. You know, we've got, in the last 5 years, the emergence of things like FinTech Australia, there's now InsurTech Australia, there's the RegTech Association, there's a whole bunch of advocacy groups that are out there really trying to shift the needle on a whole range of regulatory and policy areas that are quite critical no matter what sector you play in, like R&D, for example. And so I'm really hoping that they don't become another club of an elite group of successful entrepreneurs, that actually they use and leverage their success for the greater good and bring everyone along with them.
And in fact, just to throw another comment in there, just because Alex and I were both involved in that initial policy document that went to Treasury through FinTech Australia, I think if you could view the relaunch as almost an opportunity to reset and come out with a bang again, I think the challenge, in the old paradigm of Startup Oz was perhaps it was about changing the nature of this conversation. And hopefully that's what they can do with this kind of revamped structure and kind of intent.
Yeah. Anyway, look, I think it's terrific. I'm glad that, you know, it does feel like a better beefed up version of what Startup Oz was doing. I think they were doing a good job, but just were a bit underfueled. So hopefully they are less underfueled now and will be able to make a big impact for the whole ecosystem. So yeah, well done, Alex, and good luck to it. All right, let's keep going. We've got time for a few more. Actually, there's a few. Let me just lump all these into one almost. But there's three fintech stories that I'd love to get Alex's take on. Maybe let's just take them one at a time. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank is acquiring Ferocia, which is a fintech founded by Dominic Pym. $116 million seems to be the price tag there. Let me throw it to Lauren. Do you know much about this one or Dominic and what he's been up to?
Look, I've been a huge fan of Up Bank since its launch. I guess the context with Ferocia and Bendigo Bank is that there's always been a relationship here, and it's the story here is almost what it looks like when there's a successful collaboration between bank and technology partner. Bendigo Bank gave this incredible opportunity for Ferocia and Up to develop kind of outside of the environment and prove out a lot of assumptions that perhaps it's really hard for banks to do themselves. And they had a really symbiotic relationship through that whole process. So it's a huge credit to Dom and the team. The way that they have innovated on what it feels like to experience consumer banking and bring that very tech-centric, product roadmap strategy, shipping features fast, that whole part of the conversation has really set them apart and allowed them to scale. So it's a huge credit to them and a great validation of, fintech bank collaboration. I look forward to seeing what that means for the next chapter of
Up. Great. Well, let me throw the second question to you, and feel free to jump in on the Ferocia Bendigo Bank question in there. But Latitude is buying local fintech Simple, S-Y-M-P-L-E, and that's price tag is $200 million. So, yeah, a couple of fairly major acquisitions going on here. So, Alex, do you want to give us your take on them?
Yeah, look, it's really great news, number one, and what I like about both of these examples is that we're not talking about innovation at the fringe of a business or something that's hugely speculative or opportunistic. What we're seeing here is innovation happening at the core of an existing operation. And by that, we're talking about Bendigo in the case of Ferocia and obviously Latitude when it comes to Simple. And that's where I think a lot of the most meaningful innovation actually happens and where the biggest opportunities for collaboration can also occur. The one to do with Latitude, I think, is really interesting on a number of fronts. The first one is that we're talking about a $200 million price tag for a company in Simple that's only really been operating for around 3 years. The second is the fact that we're looking at collaboration from a supply chain perspective or really a platform capability perspective. So here, like Bendigo and like many other large corporates, for example, they've recognized that they've got limitations around what they can do internally. And they've very cleverly looked at partnering, and in this case, acquiring a scale-up to bring capability into their core business. And here we're talking about their enhanced lending platform, for example. Now, the real kicker for me in this case is usually when you see a coupling or a partnership between a scale-up and a large organization, it's usually the scale-up that's trying to access the corporate's customer base, for example. Whereas what you've got here is an example of Simple that's already accessed the Canadian market. And as part of the deal, you've got Latitude now looking to grow into New Zealand and into Canada through Simple's established operations, a company that's 3 years old. And so there's three key layers here that I just wanted to point out that I thought were phenomenal about this as a case study. And I think there's huge opportunities for Australian corporates and institutions to really look at this example and see, wow, there's quite a lot that we can do in terms of time to market and actual cost to market by learning from what Latitude have done. And in many ways, what we've been referring to at Stone & Chalk for some time now, innovating from the outside in.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's remarkable. Like, I mean, fintech in particular seems to have a way of accelerating. Like, if you get it right, I mean, the market is so huge and the opportunity is so great that, I mean, hearing an example like this from zero to $200 million acquisition in 3 years, I mean, that's amazing. I actually just had Ben Pfisterer from Zeller on the podcast, and you know, he's raised tens of millions. I think it's like 50 million or 40 million from some huge investors. And he hasn't even got a product quite out. Well, he kind of does, but it's a year and a half. So, I mean, the pace is intense. Michael, any thoughts? I mean, is fintech particularly suited to this ridiculous pace that we're seeing from some companies?
Not necessarily on the simple deal, but on the app deal. I mean, that's kind of resonating to with Lauren's comments here as well. Like, they just completely rethought what fintech actually really meant and approached it completely from like a product and engineering side of things rather than from a financial engineering side of things, which really showed in like the customer love, which you actually see all over the internet, all over Twitter, which is just an incredible achievement.
Yeah. I mean, linked to that, I mean, there was an article in Startup Daily in the last few weeks saying that VC investment in fintech has hit almost just under $100 billion US, that is, just in the first half of 2021. I mean, look, the capital markets are running hot. I mean, just combined off the back of that was another article from CB Insights about corporate venture capital, saying that in the first half of 2021, there was $80 billion. So that's $100 billion that went into fintechs and $80 billion that came from CVCs. And that that $80 billion from the corporate venture capital compares to a complete total of last year. So that first 6 months of this year is bigger than the $74 billion, which was for the whole of 2020. Alex, capital markets running hot, like, what should we be alarmed or excited by what we're hearing with these big numbers?
Oh, very much so. You know, I remember giving presentations 2 to 3 years ago to boards, chairs, CEOs, and even at conferences showing these types of numbers from CB Insights, where every year the trend was almost increasing by 50% in terms of what was the cumulative global investment that was going into fintech. And I remember fielding many a comment and an opinion that the bubble was going to burst and, you know, everything was going to peter out and everything would continue in terms of financial services the way it was pre-fintech. And there's quite a few naysayers in some of that, in those discussions as well. And so to be sitting here in the middle of what is still a global pandemic, to be seeing these types of numbers of investment going into fintech and the significant component of that is coming from corporate venture capital, I think is again illustrating the kind of trends that we'll probably most likely continue to see here in Australia and growing in terms of the Latitudes and the Bendigos and the CBAs and the other banks and institutions, not just in fintech, but I think across all sectors of emerging technology, where firms start to realize that actually one of the greatest sources of competitive advantage don't necessarily need to come from within, but can come from, once again, you know, innovating from the outside in with these types of organizations. And so I think it's going to be very exciting for founders.
All right. Well, look, thank you. We're running short on time. Let's maybe take one more story, maybe two if we can get it. We don't often talk about the Kiwi market here. We probably should, but I think we talk about it more in the podcast than we do in the news show. And we have had a couple of Kiwis in the show, but Crimson Education, which is an Auckland-based company run by a young, talented founder called Jamie Beaton, it's raised at over $600 million valuation. And the news here is that Kevin Rudd has joined their board. Now, I'm not sure whether that's surprising or not. I mean, it's, you know, startups and Kevin Rudd are not things that come out your mouth normally in the same sentence. Anyone want to jump on this one? Know anything about New Zealand or Crimson or the education market or Kevin Rudd?
Well, he's a neighbor of mine somewhere up here in Sunshine Beach. That's my contribution. No, one of my colleagues at Reinventure actually did used to work at Crimson. And I think that I've always been aware of it as, you know, an incredibly fast growing startup and just how important innovation in the education sector is. I think we're still only seeing the start of what it looks like for, you know, obviously things like Forage as well. You know, what does it look like to reinvent education or different pathways to education? But perhaps the point here is more around political connection to startups and where we're seeing some of these ex-politicians. I mean, Malcolm Turnbull certainly has done similar things in terms of investment into startups and the power that gives the business, you know, to move in different directions or to form different kinds of relationships in their growth pathways. I think that's becoming, you know, a strategic advantage in certain sectors, you know, maybe some over others. And, you know, fintech, cybersecurity, education probably will fall into that camp because they're such highly regulated or, you know, government-run kind of industries at the same time.
Yeah. I've got an embarrassing story I should tell with relation to Crimson. Like when I was at AWS, there was an internal chat with my team about whether we should support them with credits and what we thought. But and I shouldn't have put this in writing, so it was my mistake. But, you know, I took an immediate view, as you sometimes do with these companies, and Jamie is like one of these high profile, super smart, you know, fairly, you know, he's got a swagger about him. And I think in the email I said that, you know, I thought he was a little arrogant and deluded, which was completely unfair. And I say, and Jamie, if you're listening, I apologize. But this went in the email thread, and then my team member did a reply all, including Jamie, and forgot to take that out. So it was one of those moments when we realized we're like, holy shit, this is really bad. So I spent just about the entire day crawling on my belly to put on Jamie. Oh, yeah, anyway. A good outcome from that was I did get half an hour on the phone with Jamie explaining why I was sorry and hearing a bit more about his business. But I don't think he's forgiven me. So sorry, Jamie. Anyone else got a thought on this one, or Kevin Rudd? Like, why is Kevin Rudd joining startups? Alex?
I've got no idea, frankly, Ian. I think it's a challenge we should issue Lauren to go across and ask him and report back.
maybe he just needs the money.
I've passed him on the beach once. I might have to do a few more sunset walks to find him. I think it's smart. I think there's, yeah.
Mm. I was just going to say, I'll tell you what, I think it's a good thing. If anything, it shows that, you know, Malcolm perhaps has been, as Lauren said, one of the more notable politicians that has, you know, or ex-politicians that has invested in startups, and where startups have very happily used their profile to help forward their business. And I think, you know, that if anything, is going to help bring more attention to the broader public about startups. About companies such as these, and not just about it being of direct benefit to the business that they're investing in or being a part of in some way, but actually, you know, one of the key things that I think all of us struggle with more broadly is how do we extend the narrative around the importance of startups, scale-ups, emerging technology to actually Australia's future, to the everyday mum and dad that reads the, you know, the newspapers, for example. And I think the more headlines we have like that, the easier it is to bring that awareness to every man and his dog that actually digging things out of the ground isn't the future of the country. It's the creation of these IP-based businesses that can easily scale internationally and provide us the growth that we need. So that's that from my perspective. If anything, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. All right. Look, we are officially out of time. So I would like to say a huge thank you to this amazing panel. That was a great conversation. So Lauren, Michael, from both of you from Startmate, love your work and what you're doing. So keep it up. And Alex, former CEO at Stone & Chalk, good luck with the future. We're all rooting for you. And if we can do anything to help with whatever else you're doing, let us know. And look, thanks everyone for joining, and we'll see you in the next one.